We for whom the home hoorays, smiles and wins us limestone praise, holds ceramic arms to God, says, heaven, in voice 11 stories noised, however tall its actual wall, having made the maker I reshape, and who my gaping arches take, so steepled I will people wake, and all point up to you. Though church my schemers not, no aeronaut a better perch was given, so high my gaze is risen.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Soul Scene. This week we are talking about the one, the only Antoni Gaudí, Spanish architect. Aaron's poem seems to be a bit of an ode to him and his life, his faith, his creativity. Tell me about the poem.
Thank you. It was inspired by him, of course. I thought it'd be a good introduction to the conversation. Gaudí was, by all accounts, quite a God-fearing man, which on So A Scene Where We Design a Utopia is almost neither here nor there because we don't want to prescribe different religions. We do that off microphone enough. but I really love this quote that I've had in the back of my mind for like a decade, that architecture is frozen music and music is liquid architecture. And there's this kind of unique place that I think it occupies among the arts as the most directly dealing with humanity's place in the universe. Mm-hmm. And whether you want to consider that religiously or not, it's up to you, obviously. But Gaudí did so. He was kind of nicknamed God's architect for that reason. And that's why I kind of have in the poem, even if it's not a church per se, you're still kind of making statements adjacent to worship, to spirituality in any case. So I thought that would be kind of a good baseline opener, if a little bit heavy, but also fun.
Yeah, I think if we have spirituality as a part of our lives, any space can become a church. And Gaudí really leaned into that, whether it was making a park, making a home, or literally making a church. He erected it as a bit of a shrine or a bit of a space to evoke thought. Because often when churches are designed, you think, oh, the roofs are always decorated so that you can look upwards, and that's metaphorical but also literal, just changing your posture. But he created even homes to have that sort of effect.
Right. Something I've been thinking about this week is that people will always use that example that you just did about churches pointing the gaze upwards, and because they are often tall and angled up to the heavens, or other religious buildings, they make you feel meaningful. And maybe they'll contrast it with, you know, the drabbest, squarest, flattest, brutalist building you can find and say, these ones make you feel like ants. But it's a really interesting contrast where it's kind of like, just ostensibly, if you're in a massive, pointy, spacious building, you should feel small. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like but you don't, is what I'm saying. And if you're in the kind of claustrophobic and very rectangular and dull building, you should kind of feel big.
Mm.
But there's
it's the opposite.
It's the opposite, yeah. But that's just that's an aside. So today we're talking about Gaudí, his style, his life. We're drawing lessons for our beautiful, sustainable, tactile Soa Scene, and we are pretty much adding him to the Rushmore of now 10 or 11 people that we've covered through the semester. It's been quite a journey. He's the first architect. Mm. So he's the most kind of concrete, pun intended, example of someone you visualize when you think about your utopia.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's the patron architect of the Soa Scene, let's say. I don't think all the buildings there look like him, but they can definitely take some cues.
Absolutely. And funny enough, Gaudí was quite the utopianist. Hmm. I made up that word. Perhaps it already exists, but okay. He had a lot of thoughts about utopia and even some attempts to build small communes based on utopian principles. So we'll get to that as we talk about his life. Gaudí was Catalan, which was quite an important part of his identity as a person and as an artist. He wasn't actually born in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. He was born in Reus, which is just southeast within Catalonia, and it's just west of Barcelona, so pretty close. I'm sure he had visited Barcelona a few times in his childhood, but until he went to school, secondary school, he remained in this smaller town. And as a child, he was sickly. And that's my first Solocene recommends, sickly children going in the country.
My first Solocene recommends, having some kind of rheumatism as a child.
Yes. It seems like every great artist, scientist, maybe it was just all kids back in the day.
I have noticed that as a kind of, you know, maybe Malcolm Gladwell should write a book about that. Because I think he, in Outliers, he specifies that like a weirdly high percentage of really successful CEOs and artists are orphans or have some similar tragic youth. So yeah, I have noticed that maybe you just notice it more though. You know what I mean? Like maybe there's just a lot of sick children.
Yeah, especially in the mid-19th century. Of course, there were way more sick children. But I just found it funny because I was reading about his life and this stood out. And it's a big part of his inspiration was him spending a lot of time in the country. So even away from the small town, he went full on into the country. They had a home there and spent a lot of time with nature.
It seems like it's a running theme throughout our Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably something to do with having a lot of time to oneself rather than like kicking a ball around and being contemplative.
Yeah, absolutely.
From a young age.
His parents were boilermakers, and this is often ascribed to his seeming aptitude for working with spaces and volumes. He was first and foremost an incredible architect, not necessarily a creative.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to work with tension and compression and build really structurally sound buildings came first.
Yeah.
And from that expertise, he became so creative.
I had those two notes as well to mention. Being the son of coppersmith,
mm-hmm.
that kind of material grounding, I think, is you can probably trace that quite directly.
Mm-hmm.
And also, yeah, the fact that he was, by all accounts, quite a pragmatist, which when you look at the buildings, which I understand it might be frustrating for listeners because they might be like, oh, I know the name. I can't quite picture the buildings, but I guess you have the internet as a companion. You can mm-hmm. always search them up because I have listened to architecture podcasts before and yeah, I've been quite, it's not the most satisfying experience because they're discussing these buildings, which obviously exist visually and you can do it with the most kind of painterly language, but it's always going to be just a verbal kind of adumbration for the listener. It's similar to when you hear grandmasters discuss their chess games.
Yeah.
And really rapidly, they'll be like, oh yeah, e4, c5, knight takes h6, blah, blah, blah. Just rattling off these lines. And you're like, I can kind of picture it, but it's slightly a frustrating experience. So sorry about that, I guess, for people listening. But yeah, his pragmatism, when you see these buildings that look like something straight out of a fantasy or almost slightly Dr. Seussian, you wouldn't imagine him to be, as you said, quite a principled architect in terms of, it's not like they were always teetering. Mm-hmm. Like they were very solid constructions and he was making string models of things to kind of simulate the amount of tension that would be bore in different areas of the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I liked was that his plans for these projects were often kind of liquid. They would develop as he went rather than just like one formal schematic from the start that we'll work from. He was often even on site consulting with the different construction workers there,
which
is something that I really, you wouldn't expect, I'd say, just by looking at them. You'd think it's like some madman holed away in a desk that's the size of a house, which was another one of his failed projects. But no, he was, seems like a man of the people.
Yeah.
At least became one during his life.
Absolutely. I think that stems from his upbringing, seemingly quite humble middle class person. A lot of historic geniuses came from more aristocratic circles.
Right.
Because of the class divide in a lot of parts of the world.
I think it's also the faith.
Absolutely. Because
the stories about when he was older and it seems like he got a little bit more kind of traditionally ascetic, inside dressing like a beggar and eating very sparsely. And there was this weird kind of juxtaposition where he was quite a famous figure by the end of his life, of course, but at the same time would often walk around completely unrecognized.
Yeah.
And people would think he was just a pauper.
Yeah, and he remained unmarried his whole life. He was married to his craft and to his faith, which is also really cool to hear from an artist So from the beginning, Gaudi was talented with space and traditional architecture, but what sets him apart so much from a lot of other architects, past, present, future, because if you look at his things, they seem so futuristic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say it will remain so for a few hundred years. He was so cutting edge that we'll catch up to him eventually, but there's really nothing like it the rest of the world. Catalonian modernism was a very specific time, and he wasn't the only one designing in this style, but his were so naturalistic near the end of his life. When he began, you can see if you are familiar with his works, his early works are a bit more orientalist. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of tile work, a lot of motifs that you see in
like the
India
Middle East.
And Middle East. And then he moved into a more neo-Gothic era. But then the last chunk of his life, I would say the majority of his major works are this naturalist technique that he used. And a few things that he said in his lifetime concerning this was he developed this really great respect for nature and its mysteries and thought of it as his personal supreme mistress, like mm-hmm. his muse was nature, but also as God's crowning glory of creation. And I feel like that's really interesting. We'll talk about it a bit later when we talk about the soul scene, of not necessarily thinking of humans as the pinnacle, but of nature, because humans are a part of that. But when we set ourselves apart and say humans are the crowning glory of creation, I think that can make us a bit uncreative in a way and small-minded.
I actually have a wonderful tie-in for that, which is this week's villain of the week.
Do, 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 do.
And I told you who it was yesterday. It's Howard Roark, who was, until this week or so, the only other architect with whom I was this familiar. Of course, he's a fictional architect. He is the main character of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which I'm not going to say is a Solocene recommends. It's not exactly one of the foundational texts for our utopia. Unfortunately, it was a book that I have quite a deal of details on, because in that most desperate time of any student's life, hunting for scholarships, when we were in high school, so this is grade 12, so we were like 17, I came across the Ayn Rand scholarship online, which I'm sure has hooked many a prospective undergrad.
Mm.
And the game was basically read one of her just massive books, The Fountainhead. I think it's like 700 or 800 pages, and write an essay on it. Unfortunately, I didn't win, but I did place. And so I got like a minor, I think I got like $50.
Mm-hmm.
And crucially, I'm still a member of the Ayn Rand like youth club or whatever. And every year they send me an email about their getaway, which looks almost exactly as you'd expect
it. That sounds like one of my worst nightmares, an Ayn Rand getaway. It's like, we're going to go live in a brick cube and talk about finances.
Right. So Howard Roark, I picked him as quite the foil to Antoni Gaudi, in that he is Rand's example of American individualism triumphing over the collective. That's kind of the story of The Fountainhead.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in some ways, and the book is in some ways, a proponent of her pet philosophy, objectivism, which I won't detail fully for those here. Maybe I'll link my essay in the comments where I had to sound like I had to kind of suck up, which was, I guess, not my finest moment of academic integrity.
Or just like personal integrity. I feel like they could really sell out the fact that you are not an individualist.
You are but his style is described in the book as very minimalistic and utilitarian, similar to Gaudi. I think there are more than a couple similarities, in that he, in a sense, flouts convention and is like, the book starts with him in architecture school,
mm-hmm.
not really appreciated by his superiors, which was mm-hmm. the case with Gaudi also, because he took quite a liberal approach to style. He would mix Gothic with the contemporary, as well as his own kind of burgeoning proto Art Nouveau stylings.
Mm-hmm.
And he often was a great respecter of previous styles, but also looked at them really as sources of inspiration in terms of, how could this have been done better?
Mm.
How could this be improved upon? Howard Roark was more like, I hate everyone and everything that isn't this. And I think his designs were slightly modeled after Frank Lloyd Wright, who was big in America at the same time as Rand was writing, who is another architect that I think is super cool and would actually be quite a Socine style. Like, it's not so much about the aesthetics. It's more about the way that you go about enacting those or embodying those, I suppose. That said, I don't even think the Fountainhead is all bad. I think you can kind of read it as just a peon or a treatise on aesthetic purity and kind of not compromising your vision, which may be similar to Gaudi. But still, Howard Roark is a villain, and there's a very problematic scene featuring him in the book. So,
yeah, it's definitely not a Solzhenitsyn recommends, but it is perhaps partially inspirational for our design, our idea to design a utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think exposing ourselves to ideas like individualism, like Ayn Rand ideas, can make you more familiar with, I didn't realize people even thought this way.
That's a great point, because I think, and this podcast might ostensibly be quite guilty of it, it's so easy to surround yourself in a bubble with people you agree with, books that you know you're going to like before you even read them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is pretty much the one case where I've delved deep into something that I disagreed with quite vehemently for the sake of money at the end of it. But I do think it strengthens your ideas and it strengthens your own convictions. And it can make you more open-minded as well.
Absolutely. So you're talking about the time period when Gaudi went to architecture school. So he didn't just think, oh, I don't need school, I'm a prodigy. He did go and study. And my favorite thing about that experience was the dean or whoever awarded the degree to him at the end said, I do not know if we have awarded this degree to a madman or to a genius. Only time will tell. Yeah, and I want that to be my legacy. Someone to be like, I don't know if she was a little bit off her rocker or if she's going to go and like do a lot of greatness, because it's a fine line.
It is.
And I feel like a lot of great historical artists, inventors, scientists have ridden that line and teetered one way or the other.
Yeah, there are many wonderful quotes from his life, either said by people around him or said by him. You were talking about his naturalism and the way he took inspiration from nature's shapes first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
I also love this quote, which is ascribed to him when asked about the Sagrada Familia, which was the church which occupied pretty much all of the end of his life and is still not built. I don't think will be built for quite a while. It's under construction, should I say. It's still not finished. Again, excuse the pronunciation on that one. But he said, when he was asked, do you consider this in the lineage of great churches? And he was like, no, it's the first of a new kind.
Mm.
It's a new lineage, basically.
Absolutely.
Which sounds mildly egotistical, but also just accurate. So,
I think so. Yeah.
Speaking of quotes, I have one that I wanted to read out. You and I watched a documentary on Gaudi, which maybe that is a Socine recommends for this week, because it was a really fun experience. It was about 70 minutes long. It's on YouTube. It's just called Antoni Gaudi, and it was made in 1984. It's Japanese, but there's almost no speaking throughout. It's just footage of the buildings with this kind of almost ethereal score in the background. It looks more like a sci-fi than any kind of documentary that you'll usually see. There was some dialogue. Unfortunately, it was dubbed into Japanese, so we missed out on that. But the quote I wanted to read is from a Letterboxd review for said film. It's someone I follow. His name on the site is Mateowah, Mateowah. But he also has a Vimeo where he makes his own short films, which are kind of cool. His name is Matteo Krigowski. And his review said, in its growth, a tree branches out in the form of a spiral. His hope was a pillar, even if only one, could be just like a natural tree, connected everywhere with no breaks or gaps. That was a quotation that he cited in his review. And then he wrote, the physical protrusion of Earth pertaining to its marriage with human innovation. Tumor-like lesions of concrete split into gaping, wounded structures, contused by centuries of time and unbroken light, permanently stained. Each gyre of stone erected by Gaudi spells out the sharply immediate vitality of nature. Prior to any spoken language, curving deep into grooves of splintering metals that are displayed as coils of warmth. Living, breathing creatures that awaken by dusk. iridescent scales to defend, along with phantoms that cry in silence, standing tall and staring into the distant horizon. Which I just thought was great poetry and really well written. It's a bit of a strange source to cite, but what I loved about this review was it articulated about the style something which is hard to otherwise say. It's not just pretty. It's in a sense sometimes kind of ugly.
It's it's pretty in the way that when you look at a cell or look at the inside of a human body of this is appalling in a way because we have that innate
aversion or disgust almost.
Disgust for the ultra organic. Mm-hmm. But you also see the beauty in it in the case of natural things, something created this or a science, like this is unreal that it exists. And his architecture takes on a bit of that, of it has this slight aversion to it because it's so natural and so sprawling. But I mean, the Sagrada Familia, which is the church in Barcelona, a lot of people will probably recognize it. It looks like termite mounds. I mean, even in that description, like termite mounds don't look good.
And it doesn't sound like, that's a church. They sound like two contradictory images.
Yeah, and you were saying it reminds you a lot of Alien, the movie,
H.R. Giger was one reference point that I thought. Obviously, Gaudi is nothing so dark. I wouldn't say it's creepy in that sense. And it is very often pretty. Like, I'll say that. Mm-hmm. I just mean it isn't just pretty.
Yeah.
Like, it's very rich and interesting, and it feels like you could stare at it and explore it with your eyes for a long time. Mm-hmm. And with your body. It's not easy on the eyes, let's put it like that.
Yeah.
And similar to last week when we were talking about Gustave Moreau, and I said I felt a bit of reticence proclaiming him one of my favorite painters until we went to see a lot of his works in Paris.
Mm.
I do feel a touch of that with architecture, especially because paintings are 2D. So you're not missing out that much in terms of the actual viewing by seeing them on a screen, whereas buildings are three-dimensional. You can go inside them, you can stand before them and really get a sense for scale. You can hear like acoustics, you can touch them. Like it's just so much, it's an entirely different thing to see this facsimile of it on even what was a nice documentary versus going there. So I had the question for you, what's your favorite building that you've been in or visited? I know it's a bit of a big question. I'll answer mine first to give you time to think. It was when we went to Rome and there was that big neoclassical, like massive building that was called the Monument to Victor Emmanuel II. Do you remember that? We could climb the stairs on the outside. There were flags.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think you go inside.
Yeah.
It was the most kind of grand and just impressive building that I've personally visited. And also in terms of the experience versus just the visual of it, when you're in these places, you get the sense for the location and the sight lines and the way that roads may lead up to it, or there may be a piazza in front of it. And then we're saying, why don't we have piazzas why aren't there any squares in North America?
Mm.
That's just a side gripe, but we should have squares.
Yeah, I'm going to get into squares a bit later.
We're in Montreal. There's a lot of corners, but no squares.
Yeah, so weird.
Doesn't add up.
For me, there's obviously a lot of impressive buildings in Europe, but the first thing that came to my mind was the Mary Queen of the World Church in Montreal.
Oh yeah, that's really nice.
Because North America is such a young group of countries. And so a lot of things, even that were built a couple hundred years ago, have been destroyed and remodeled. But this church is right in the heart of downtown Montreal. And you walk in and it's shaped like a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't notice that at first, but so it's a church, and normally churches are long hallways with an altar at the front, but this has the altar in the middle, and there's offshoots, these incredible paintings, incredible crypts, and the outside of the building is massively impressive, but the inside has this hallowed space feeling that I don't know I've felt anywhere else. A lot of people in Montreal specifically, we'll talk about the Oratory Church,
right,
which is this really modernist design on the inside. And it's interesting because until seeing that church, I'd never seen any interior of a church that wasn't the more Baroque.
Yeah, so minimalist.
Yeah.
And there's rock underground.
Yeah.
Like you can go and tour just like this cave underneath.
It's built into the mountain. Yeah. And that church really reminds me of Gaudi's work in that it was saying this is a church, but it's going to be modern. But I think for me, yeah, the Mary Queen of the World church is the coolest that I've seen. I thought we could maybe talk a little bit about a couple of Gaudi's failed projects and the aesthetics that were perhaps born out of those that inspired his later work. So when he was young, maybe it reminds me of us quite a bit. Him and his friends had this idea of planning out a utopia. And they said, we're going to take over this old abandoned monastery and turn it into a utopian community. And I feel like when I was a kid, that was the type of thing that whenever I'd see an abandoned house, abandoned even storefront, my mind would immediately go towards, wow, this is so much potential. What could we create from it? And he had this whole plan of like what would be involved, how many people would live there. But obviously, it was just when he was a kid and that didn't go forward. He also apparently unsuccessfully founded a wrought iron company, which seems really funny because you'd think someone like him would be very focused on architecture, but he thought about the materials quite a lot.
That's what I love about it. It's such a holistic kind of view of the medium.
Yeah, so he didn't get up on his high horse and say, I'm just an architect. He was like, I want to be hands-on making these wrought iron sculptures. And I think with the Sagrada Familia, the reason that I don't love it that much is the material issue, because when he started building it, he was using a very specific type of sandstone from a certain region. And sandstone, depending on where you get it from, has a different color because of the mineral composition. And it ran out, the supply. So now as they're finishing up the Sagrada Familia, if there's ever an old building torn down in Catalonia that was built with that sandstone, the priority is to put it towards the building, which I think is really cool. So it's made up of old pieces of the Olympic Stadium from there, old homes even. But when you look at it, it's all different colors. There's like white ones because those have a higher quartz content and so on. And it's, I think, a unity of material is really important to me. But Gaudi did the opposite in a lot of, like, he didn't plan for the Sagrada Familia to be with all these different materials, but in a lot of his other ones, he did intentionally use a mixture of mosaic, wood, plaster, and he does it in this way that I'll give a pass to him because he does it so fluidly. And it tells such a story in a way that a lot of other places, it's like, oh, we're going to do a kind of cool mishmash, but it doesn't come together. And his also doesn't come together, but it's immersive, it feels like.
I think there's something so ahead of its time, and we throw the word solarpunk around quite a bit on this podcast. His style and a lot of his ethos seems to me more solarpunk by definition than the typical glassy skyscrapery with green roofs renders that you see populating those aesthetic images, which is really interesting. I mean, he was kind of notable for using waste ceramic shards and making these pretty mosaics out of them. And also just the biomimicry. I mean, when you see the initial sketches for the Sagrada Familia, it literally just looks like an Art Nouveau forest. It looks like something you'd see in the background of Sleeping Beauty, where it's just these triangular shapes that, it just looks like stylized trees, which is really, it's such a crazy thing. And I love, it kind of makes the urbanism and the nature this more cohesive unity. Mm-hmm. Like if you could imagine a city where everything was designed by Gaudi, it would look like a tree city or something.
Absolutely.
But also really fun. And obviously there's a human hand there. And I think that principle of fun is something that makes his work stand out so much. Because when you consider great architecture, it's almost always gray and white and quite geometric. I'm not an architecture student, so it may just be a misconception I have or a bias. But there's something about just the sense of playfulness in the shapes that he used. Probably my favorite of his works that I would most like to visit and is on my equivalent of a bucket list is called Güell Park in the middle of Barcelona. And it looks like this, I don't know, like this really stylized Disneyland. And there's this giant continuous bench running through it, which is snaking with these curves that you just, I don't know, you don't see that kind of thing very well. Or there's a terrace where there's these wonderful kind of curved stone railings, I suppose. And that just chiefly they look like they would be fun places to be and fun places to walk around in. And it's fun without that kind of postmodern self-awareness or irony, which is what I love about it so much.
Yeah, it's childlike and naive, because especially with that park, which originated as a bit of a Disneyland type idea of creating a suburb, because at the time it was suburban, it wasn't right in the heart of Barcelona like it is now because of expansion and whatever. So him and Guiel was the name of the other person working on the project, started designing this park, and it was meant to be a walled community, but Gaudí had these sort of collectivist ideas and said, no, I don't want it to be completely walled. Like, why would we put all this effort into creating this beautiful space when the general public won't be able to access it? So the most common image you see is the entryway with the lizard fountain, and it's this grand welcoming entryway to the park. And it was meant to be a collection of 60 homes. There ended up only being 2 homes built in there because it wasn't accepted by the city or by people.
Yeah.
And he actually lived out most of his days living in one of those homes in the park.
Oh, wow. One note, I guess, about that kind of collectivist ethos, graffiti, that's a solo scene doesn't really recommend.
Yeah, there'll be no graffiti in the solo scene.
I don't know. It's an awkward thing to talk about because I know graffiti is ancient and I know it was all over ancient Rome and it's not like a modern phenomenon, but it feels like there's a distinctly modern embrace of it, which maybe what I'm against, it's kind of municipalities and governments trying to be hip and be like, oh, graffiti, nice.
Yeah, we commissioned this graffiti artist to do the side of all the buildings. And I think it's...
I feel like there's a kind of ego to it.
Yeah.
I know people view it as like a kind of rebellion against the man. But I don't... I guess I like cleanness.
I think also in the solo scene, you respect that even this, like the apartment we live in, that someone built it and someone designed it. I get it. I mean, I'd graffiti one of those like tall glass towers that there's 1,000 of in the city. But it's just like...
Did you say you've graffitied one?
No, no.
Oh.
I'd say like, I can see kind of standing up to the man by graffitiing one of those because it's like, be creative, please.
Yeah.
But a lot of things are creative and we don't need to destroy them.
Well, I think it's 2 things. One, people are probably a bit dismayed about the blocks that they see all around them. And 2, they don't feel they have that kind of creative agency elsewhere in life, which is a conversation for a different day. It's just, graffiti... a no-go. I had a quote from John Ruskin, who was an English writer and philosopher, who was one of Gaudi's kind of big inspirations in life, I think. And he said, ornamentation is the principal part of architecture, which it just feels flies so much in the face of the really austere and copy and paste shapes that seem to dominate city building today, which leads into Gaudi's Barcelona. Something that inspired both of us, I think, is the fact that there could be a city so synonymous with a style. And Gaudi wasn't the only prominent architect building in that style, but he's who we're focusing on today. And it's kind of a universal solar scene concept for places to have identity.
Absolutely.
I said we went to Rome and I really admired all the ancient monuments, of course, but also there's a lot of neoclassical. When you go to Paris and you see all the buildings along the streets in the Haussmann style, it looks like Paris. And I think you can spread the language of English to everywhere you go and play the same movies across the planet and eat at the same McDonald's in like 1 billion cities on Earth. But those buildings and that style, that's what makes the city the city. That's the literal fabric of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's kind of inspiring about travel, period. Because if everywhere looked the same, which I know it's going in the direction of this kind of homogeneity with glassy nothingness, then there'd be no character.
Absolutely. And his commitment to using local materials and local inspiration was so inspiring to me, because we've been talking a lot lately amongst ourselves about how, yeah, you can be inspired by movies and inspired by books, but you have to go to the source. And then this was one of his most famous legacies, was saying the only way to be creative is going to the source, which is going to nature or going to God in his case. And I think we can really lean into that in the solo scene for creating a more diverse literal landscape of cities and of cultures because everything's homogenizing. And I think going back to the source of saying, well, in our place, we have these types of trees and I want to make columns that look like these types of trees, mm-hmm. or not so literally as that, but even inspired by food, being inspired by the seasons instead of being like, I'm going to have salad year round. Like, that doesn't make sense if you live in a certain place.
Something else I love about the Barcelona connection is that it seems his work is embedded into the everyday to an extent. So like one of his first commissions was street lamps.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of street lamps there that are just designed by him. Yeah. And they look very distinct. They look like Gaudian street lamps because they were. And that's the kind of small, or like in Paris where you see the font for the metro. Mm-hmm. It's like that's a very Parisian thing and you don't see that elsewhere. I love those kind of everyday interactions with design because architecture often can be a grand neoclassical monument that looms over you and the rest of you are living in boxes.
Yeah.
Or it can be a democratic prospect. And I think that's what Gaudi would really love.
I think so. I mean, he made houses and said houses and furniture should be beautiful. And an unrealized project that he also did was a series of news booths. So you know those booths where you sell newspapers, but he wanted to include in them public toilets, flower shops, barometers so you could see the weather, and clocks, and just making these tiny little things accessible but beautiful.
I love his furniture. His furniture is so cool. And the interiors of the buildings as well.
Yeah.
And that's why I mentioned the park with the bench. It's like a bench. Anyone can sit on there or read on there or do whatever. Yeah. Another example of this is actually in your hometown. Something that's always struck me is that the fire hydrants are painted to be like tiny dudes.
They all have a little
character. They look like minions, kind of.
Yeah.
But they're not all yellow. And I just, I always thought that was so cute and such a, it's a character of the thing. It's not like Gaudi, you know, it's not a world famous thing, but it doesn't have to be. And it just makes you remember it more and it makes you like it more and it gives you more of an affinity. Or we mentioned in another episode how Prince Edward Island, the roads are just red.
Yeah.
And it's just like, because they have the red stone there.
Exactly.
There's something so wonderful about that. Makes the world feel a lot bigger.
A couple more soul scene lessons I learned from Gaudi's life were patience. Things aren't going to change overnight. The Sagrada Familia has taken, I think, close to 150 years now. It's still not completed.
Yeah.
But be patient. And if you have this vision, try and make the vision so strong that it's contagious and other people want to complete it. And this can go with even small scale things of perhaps, for example, when you and I moved to Montreal, we said we're going to furnish our place slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent 6 months trying to find a couch, 3 months trying to find the right TV stand.
Yeah, 3 years later, still trying to find a bed.
Don't have a bed, don't have a rug. Never ended up getting a rug. But it's being patient, and then you actually grow an affinity for the things around you.
I think the only kind of design or accumulation regrets we've had are when we've been impatient and said, I'll just get it from IKEA.
Exactly.
Because then it's tended to fall apart.
Yeah, we've gotten rid of almost all of the rash IKEA purchases that we made when we first moved here because they just fell apart. And then that ends up being like just financially and sustainability-wise not strong. Another lesson is respect for all. This comes to the end of his life where, as you said, he was becoming more of an aesthetic and he appeared as a beggar, so he died by being hit by a tram and then was in the street suffering, but no one would help him because they just thought he was worthless. But you never know who is.
Yeah, it's like a story from Ovid or something like that.
Exactly.
You never know who's knocking on your door.
Yeah, so I think that's obviously been mythologized through Ovid and through countless other stories of, it could be the queen knocking on your door disguised as a witch, but you need to just respect everyone.
Yeah.
And they don't need to innately have value in your eyes, but lend a helping hand. Because we picture things used to be all chummy, community-based, but this was 100 years ago and they were still disrespecting people. So it's not
necessarily... No, it's not new that people are rude.
Yeah.
Let's put it
exactly.
Like that.
So we need to make it new that people are nice.
I had a final note, which is more of a vibe. It's more of a vibes episode anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, who are we kidding? The whole podcast is... vibes. So it's in vibes. That could be like our music channel. It's about just letting yourself, not as the designer, but as the designee, maybe, as the person experiencing those buildings, music, arts, whatever it may be, letting yourself be swept away in it. Because I think we have so many shields that we put up and we want to be coolly cool. And when you see a really inspiring or impressive building, like if you're with a group of people, you're kind of like, oh yeah, nice. Because you have to play it cool and play it kind of straight faced. But I think sometimes you can just get, fall to your knees and cry out or something like that.
Yeah.
Or we were walking yesterday and we saw a woman barefoot in this tiny square of soil with the tree, just with her head against it. I don't know what the situation was, but there's something, just that vulnerability. Or I was watching this video about how Hans Zimmer composed, or claims to have composed, one of the songs for Dune Part 2, and they started playing it. And I know he's a bit of a, he's a bit of a performer, so it might have been a little bit for the camera, but you could just, you could see the music kind of wash over his eyes, and he just kind of went quiet for a moment and was, you can tell, properly listening to it in a way that most of us don't. And this is someone who's made a career out of music, and so in some, to some eyes, might be more dulled and desensitized to the beauty of a particular melody. But it was the opposite. You know, he has, he retained that enthusiasm for it and that love for it. And so that's why I think that's a very Solosian principle.
Absolutely. While looking into Gaudi's portfolio, I did many a virtual tour of the buildings and ideally would be able to visit them someday, but preparing for this episode, we didn't exactly have the budget to go to Barcelona for some field research.
Maybe in a year.
Yeah. But this one house in particular was my favorite, Casa Balto, and I encourage people to look into it. And it was aquatic themed, which is a very Solosian thing of having land things inspired by aquatic. And a few lessons I learned from just looking at the interiors were that we're very obsessed with symmetry. I say we're living in Wes Anderson's world, perhaps, and a lot of design principles, be it graphic design or otherwise, rely a lot on symmetry. But I'm going to try a bit to lean into a lack of symmetry, because in nature, there's both. We get obsessed with, oh, wow, it's crazy. There's these concentric circles in trees and in snail shells. And I think that's really cool. But there's also the sprawling branches of trees. And in the basement of Casa Balto, there's this 10D experience, where, which seemed like the most terrible juxtaposition I've ever seen. So you walk through this house, everything is inspired by seashells, and like there's this area which is just a laundry room, but it looks like you're in the spine of a fish. It's incredible. And on the roof, there's this abstract representation of St. George fighting the dragon. And so there's a dragon's spine, and there's St. George's cross, and it's this story, this, the building is inspired by mainly dragons, but also, yeah, ocean. And it's so incredible and dynamic. And I feel like you could spend years in that house and not need furniture. You could just live in the space, and it's beautiful.
So what's the chicken tendy experience?
The tendy experience is this room. You walk in, it's just black, all screens. And then it turns on and it's like five layers of photos just like washing over you, and it's called the Gaudi experience, and it's just all photos of his architecture. And I'm like, you and I often say it'd be amazing to go experience this in real life.
Yeah.
And then the people who installed this experience in the basement were like, you're literally in Barcelona, you're literally inside of one of the houses Gaudi designed, but we need to augment the experience through this sonic visual, I don't know, it's kind
assault.
It's what it seemed like. The man walked into the room and was like, wow, that was crazy. Like, that sounds like a form of torture. It's kind of like those immersive Van Gogh experiences that travel around. And it's like, I don't think being washed over with visuals and sound is good for us.
I don't want to disparage it because it might be cool. I've never been to one of those Van Gogh things. And I'm sure if we visited that house, you might feel the allure. You might want to get a little bit tendy.
Maybe. So thank you all for listening. Go look into Gaudi on your own, because it's a very visual thing. If you like visual things, you can see us on YouTube and subscribe to us on YouTube.
Watch us on YouTube. So a scene, we went viral this week. Whoa, that was so crazy. Viral for us, should I say. We got like 1,000 views on one of the videos. And wow, I'm just being recognized in the streets at this point. So it's getting crazy over here.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening/watching.